Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In this hour of the show, we have as our guest geographer Eric Swingadow from University of Manchester in the UK. He's in their School of Environment and Development, and he is here visiting the campus and will be giving a talk. His visit here sponsored by the Department of Geography and also the Department of Urban and Regional Planning. He says this. He says that although only half of the world's people live in cities, he says that we all live in an urbanized world. For him, he says the city is a great laboratory for studying the ways that nature, urbanization, and political power all come together. He also says that the big problems that we face today essentially are urban problems, and that they are problems that require an urban solution. He'll be giving a talk on the campus this afternoon, the title, Every Revolution Has Its Square, Repoliticizing the Unequal City. And one of the things that we'll be talking about is the kind of political activity that we have seen in the past couple of years, certainly in the Arab world associated with these events we call the Arab Spring, but not just there. We've seen it in Latin America, we've seen it in Europe, and we've also seen it in the United States. So I think he has some interesting things to say, and as we talk, of course, people who are listening are welcome to join the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And there's email as well. So if you'd like to send in a question or a comment that way, you can do that. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you can pick up the telephone and give us a call. And thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me.
So I thought it would be interesting for people who are listening for me to have you talk a little bit at the beginning about your field, about geography, because I think most people, they'll think back to their experiences with geography in school, and they say, oh, well, geography, that's about maps.
Yes.
And it's about where countries are, and it's about where mountains are and where rivers are, and it's about what are the main, you know, exports of countries, those sorts of things. And truly, geography is about much, much more than that.
Indeed, geography has gone to a tremendous change over the past 30 or 40 years ago. Indeed, historically, that's what most people think of when they hear the word geography, that it is about maps and chaps.
Yes, I like that.
And not unreasonably so. There was a time that geography was very much about going into the unknown, usually by white men trying to map the unknown world to them. Of course, it was very well known to those who were actually already there, but those were ignored. Now, that has changed dramatically over the past 30, 40 years or so. And the key contribution I think that geography is making today is that we all live our lives geographically. Without a geographical constitution, life is not possible. So therefore, we geographers argue that you cannot yet properly understand the condition of the world, the interconnections between places, the conditions under which places change, by taking spatial processes and dynamics seriously. In other words, geographical yet processes are constitutive of the way in which society is organized, and in the way societies are changed. You mentioned earlier the example of the urban insurrections that are dotted over the urban landscape of the world. Now, these are geographical uprisings, if there are any, and are being celebrated, at least by some, as these explosions of a desire for democratization, emancipation, etc. Now, clearly, these events take place somewhere at very specific places, like the great squares of the big cities. They do not take place in the wastelands and backwaters. It's in the heart of the city that the world comes together. And geographers have, over the past 30 years or so, begun to explore these geographical conditions as they are expressed in, for example, the extraordinary inequalities, social inequalities, which are geographically embedded and geographically structured. Think of environmental questions. Geography historically has always been concerned with the way in which humans interact with the non-human world. Now, it's precisely this interaction that some people argue is leading us to the abyss of civilization if we do not take immediate and urgent action to remedy the disastrous course that we are on. Again, it is geographers who have both empirically and theoretically explored and continue to explore these interactions and what to do so that we do not fall off the cliff.
Yeah. And for you, the place that this all comes together is the city. And you've said very, very beautifully, very wonderfully that you think for you and the kinds of things that you're interested in looking at, the city is a great laboratory because whether you're interested in environmental issues, you're interested in political activity and how people come together, you're interested in income inequality, you're interested in broadly speaking, in politics, all of that comes together in the city.
That's right. The world comes together geographically in the city, or rather, as I would prefer to call it, in the process of urbanization. That's not quite the same. When we think of a city, we think of the buildings and the concentration of people and activities, etc., within a geographically delimited area like Chicago, the city of Chicago, the city of Champaign-Urbana. I prefer to think of cities as a process, not as a thing, but as a process of continuous change and of continuous reworking of the relationships that make urban life possible. Let me exemplify this. Yeah. Right? When you were taking a shower this morning, kind of everyday urban activity, which you would feel very uncomfortable with if you were not able to do that, and magically, when you open the tap, the water flows and disappears magically in this little hole in the bottom. Do you know where your water comes from? Do you know the political, institutional, social mechanisms through which that extraordinary edifice that brings water to Urbana-Champaign, or if you were to think of cities like L.A., where it has to come from 1,000 miles away or so, you can immediately see that a very sustainability, everyday life in the city and its continuation is predicated upon an extraordinary range of social, physical, material, and environmental interactions. This morning, the first thing I do and many do is grab a cup of coffee. Now, if you peer into that cup of coffee that sustains urban life for so many people, you see the uneven geographies of the world crystallized in this liquid. Now, if you just imagine for a moment of being a geographer, if you were to do the geography of a cup of coffee, can't you see the peasants in the highlands of Ecuador sweating in the plantations under very particular labor relations often? Can you see the uneven geographies through which these landscapes are constructed, both socially and ecologically? Can you see the shipping, transport, and communication networks that are required to make sure that the beans get roasted and ultimately on your coffee table? Can you see the Chicago futures and options market speculating in the future prices of what these people down in Africa or Latin America are doing? So these are the sort of questions that I am interested in. Today, for example, most of our urban consumer life is produced in China. 70% of what I'm wearing now is actually coming from the mega factories of this capitalist wonderland called China today. And our life in Chicago, LA, New York, London, etc., is sustained and continues precisely through these extraordinary geographical networks which simultaneously, in the way they're structured, produce and reproduce extraordinary inequalities in terms of who has the right to access these relations and processes. So in that sense, for me, everything comes together in the urban. Also, in terms of the mechanisms, tactics, and strategies of trying to change for those who are committed, so to speak, to a process of transformation in more egalitarian ways, the city is precisely the locus for choreographing the procedures, actions, etc., that may, under certain circumstances, lead to forms of emancipatory change and transformation, which in turn change the urban fabric again, as well as the relations to which that urban fabric is maintained and sustained.
Just very quickly, for anybody who just didn't tune in, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Eric Svingedau, from the School of Environment and Development, University of Manchester in the UK. He's here visiting the campus, going to be giving a talk in the MillerCom series this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium. at the Spurlock Museum, South Gregory in Urbana. They're always open to the public, so if you'd like to hear from him, you can stop by. Questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. This, I think you mentioned just sort of in passing about the idea that a city is more than just a collection of buildings. There is this idea that the city is and should be a collection of people, and yet more than that, it's a place where people come together and should be, or at least there should be places where people come together and talk about important stuff.
Exactly.
And where people, you know, where there's debate and there's discussion. And this goes back to a very, very old idea we have about what a city is supposed to be.
Absolutely.
And how decision-making is supposed to happen.
Yes.
And it's something that I'm sure in a lot of places has been lost, mm-hmm. but also what's really interesting, and again, it goes back to these ideas about people in cities turning out in large numbers in public places to talk about their concerns. This is something that, in some places at least, people are trying to get back to.
Yeah.
What about that do you find interesting?
Yeah, so that is what really interests me today. I discern in the contemporary city, globally almost, mm-hmm. Two contradictory processes. On the one hand, I would argue that over the past 10 or 20 years or so, the city has changed from what used to be called the polis, this kind of encounter of people who in free and equitable ways can exchange and disagree over how to arrange their individual and common lives. That is the polis as the domain of the political. I've been arguing that this is disappearing, that the city as a democratic center has been increasingly transformed into what I and others call a post-democratic or a post-political configuration. That basically means that increasingly the political, and I'll come back to what precisely that is and what I mean by that, has been sidelined, has been colonized by a particular type of policy making, which is not the same. Policy making is, of course, an attempt to structure the city according to the imaginaries of some. Over the past 20 years, those imaginaries have been driven by what most observers call a process of neoliberalization. That basically means that the city should be arranged such that it is, as well it can possibly be, equipped to deal with a competitive, globalizing market economy. So in other words, the city has become a theater for improving and maximizing economic competitiveness. Mm-hmm. So in other words, what has happened strangely is that economics has been depoliticized and the economy has been naturalized, so to speak. The result of that has been explosion of all manner of inequalities produced precisely through this neoliberalizing drive has led to systematic exclusions of all manner of people in a variety of ways. Now, on the other hand, what we've seen emerging over the past decade or so, more or less since 2004, 2005, is a proliferation of explosions of insurgent activities that are taking an outspoken urban form too. Mm-hmm. The most canonical that most of us are familiar with are the urban uprisings in the Middle East, in Egypt, etc., which are urban uprisings. They happen in Cairo, not in the desert. And these were uprisings of those who demanded egalitarian democracy. This was a kind of generic demand, and many of us stood there to applaud the emancipatory democratic desire of the few hundred thousands or so that camped on the square in Cairo. They actually took the name of the Egyptian people. Everywhere in the media, headlines that the Egyptian people are rising up. Of course, these were not the Egyptian people rising up. Many of the Egyptian many parts of the Egyptian population were actively supporting an authoritarian repressive regime. These were Egyptians too. It's only a small part, ultimately, that rise up, that become political subjects, so to speak. Now, interestingly enough, these kind of urban insurrectional moments, which potentially can lead to a democratizing change, not necessarily so, mm-hmm. and I'm rather pessimistic about this, but can potentially lead to a democratizing movement, have been spiraling out. Europe, particularly Southern Europe, has seen an extraordinary outburst of discontent, of people who say, we have enough. We do not any longer take the geographies of the world as it has been imagined by the elites. And for them, the elites are the politicians and the bankers. So that's one type of insurgent action, an attempt to reclaim political initiative in the name of equality. However, there's also another type of insurgency that gets much less attention, which are the violent outbursts of anarchic insurgencies. I come from the UK, and perhaps some of you have seen the images in July, August, in my own town, Manchester, where I live, where there was this violent outburst of radical discontent. Now, both these forms of urban insurrections, however different they are, express a condition in which a growing number of people, some would argue the 99%, but we can argue over the percentages, but a growing number of people feel radically and totally disenchanted from what we call everyday politics. There is not any longer a trust, a belief that what we could call constituent democracies, that is our everyday way in which we organize assumedly democratic life, parties, elections, representation, etc., does not any longer function as such. A number of people feel totally disconnected and are reclaiming the political again. The political understood as demanding and staging political equality, because that is precisely the promise of e-democracy. And that is precisely why these democratizing events are staged in cities, because cities historically have always been the sites and the theaters where emancipatory politics emerged. That's why squares are ingrained so much in our collective imagination as the emblematic sites of emancipatory struggle. Think of Tiananmen Square, Red Square, Place de la Bastille, the classic place of the French Revolution, Syntagma Square, where the Greek democratic impulse started 2,000 years ago, and which is now continuously occupied and has been for a year, given the onslaught of neoliberal controlling on the people of Greece. Athens is on fire every day. You've undoubtedly seen the images, again showing this radical discontent. And that is precisely what I'm interested in a context of alleged erosion of democracy or the democratic impulse and the emergence of this kind of post-democratic consensual order in which the elites are not defaulting on their own interests, but are defaulting on the people. Let me give you an example of that, because that may sound strange. Take the strange case of Greece, where you have a government, a coalition of both center-left and center-right, Republicans and Democrats together in the government, pursuing extreme austerity measures, causing the rapid acceleration and deepening of inequalities, rampant poverty. Now, what has the Greek government done? It has defaulted. Now, it has not defaulted on the international banking system. All the loans and supports it get is not to support its people. It is to repay the interest on its debt. The Greek state today has defaulted on the Greek people. No wonder, of course, that these eruptions, some of them violent, seem to be the only conduit left for those who are so massively affected by these processes of growing inequality in a context in which the political domain, everyday political domain, has totally abandoned them.
Yeah. So why, you know, we talk about people becoming disenchanted with politics and disconnected to the point where they figure that it doesn't matter whether they participate or not.
Correct.
Obviously, here we can find plenty of examples where that is not the case, where mm-hmm. people are definitely engaged. Mm-hmm. And it may be because, you know, when one asks, well, why is that happening there and not someplace else? Because things are really much worse there. But still, in all, mm-hmm. you know, one wonders, well, why is it that 200,000 people don't turn out in Times Square in New York City, but they do in Tahrir in Cairo? Yes. What is the difference?
That's again where geography comes in. The processes of insurgent geographies take very distinct forms, and it would be obscene almost to compare what happens in Cairo with what happens in Times Square. These are very different. They operate in very different configurations. Obviously, in the Middle East, we were speaking and are speaking of authoritarian regimes. We cannot compare that with the democratic constituent organization that we find in Europe or the United States. Mm-hmm. So the forms of organization and expression are very, very different too. Yet, given that, what intrigues me is if we take the case of the United States, the Occupy movement, this sort of U.S. variant of what is happening in Europe, Latin America, Asia, and the Middle East, is that although the numbers of those who become your political subjects, that is, those who decide, I'm going to do something, I'm going to go and camp on Wall Street for 2 or 3 weeks in the middle of the winter, these are small. But what matters in such place-specific intense outbursts is how they resonate, how they, as it were, infect, how they spatialize, how they construct and begin to construct a sense of identification and the belonging. Now, I don't camp. I'm too old for that. I'm an academic. I like my coffee and wine, etc., too much in the evening. I don't go camping. But I do want to say I am one of them, too. And that is how it works. And I'm very intrigued by their impact, their effect. For example, in the World Economic Forum's risk assessment report, the World Economic Forum is this annual gathering of the elites of the world in Davos, where they try to organize the management of the world according to their own fantasies and imaginations. They produce every year a risk report. That is, what are the great risks affecting the implementation of their fantasies? Last year, the number one risk was the financial crisis, not surprisingly. This year's report stated as the number one risk, seeds of dystopia. And I thought, what the hell do they mean by seeds of dystopia? So I had to read the full report rather than just the headlines. And what they meant was precisely the proliferation of these eruptions of discontent that characterize, that dot the world map today. And they see that as one of the great risks to their architecture, to their plan of the world. Now, then I think there is something really going on. 2011 seems to have changed the contours of the world in radical ways. It has opened up things. What it will lead to, I do not know. I'm not a magician, I'm a scholar and academic. But the world today is very different from what it was 2 years ago. It is marked by, indeed, a combination of the end of neoliberal globalization as we have known it for the past 2 decades. With the financial crisis, that is dead. It has become a form of what an other geographer calls zombie neoliberalism. It continues, but no one any longer believes in it as a magical potion to solve the problems of the world. Yet at the same time, while this fantasy of a globalized, market-driven, neoliberal world in which everyone would ultimately be happy and fully incorporate on equal basis has been shattered, terminally shattered, although it continues in this kind of undead form. At the same time, there is this spiraling discontent in so many different places, often for many different reasons, in very different geographical, political, institutional, social contexts, yet sharing the same demand, staging the same practice, that is the equal capacity of each and every one to act yet politically. And that opens up all manner of possibility, some potentially enabling, some that we might want to support, others that are perhaps more problematic. And I would think that it's our task as citizens, as well as academics and what we do, to think through the potentials of this reopening of history, as a European philosopher called it a few weeks ago. He identified, or he argued, that these urban eruptions potentially, at least, reopened history again. History understood as an endless process of emancipation, where we humans try to move forward in ways of living equally, freely, and in common, democratically speaking.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, someone who clearly is listening to us on the web, because they are in California, a little outside of our broadcast area. It is a long way away. Let's talk with him here on line number four. Hello.
Hey, how are you? Yeah, calling from that port city of San Francisco. And, you know, I wanted to ask you about the origins of cities. It's my understanding that when Julius Caesar and actually long before him, the idea of capturing territories and forcing people into camps, which essentially were work camps, and they were walled cities that were essentially to hold the slaves in. And so the origins of cities, as I understand it, were basically that, and that slowly but surely, as people attained freedoms, they became merchants. But, yeah, I wonder if you could go into that and whether or not there are studies to show how captured people's wills can be broken so that they are either afraid to go back into nature or essentially cajoled into staying into cities?
Whoa, that's a very good question, but also a complex and complicated question over which there is by no means any consensus. But what we can say is that cities have always been extraordinary concentrations of natures and peoples that come from elsewhere, willingly or unwillingly. So the city is, as it were, the embodiment of unevenness and uneven development. Consider, for example, how Chicago was predicated upon the urbanization of wheat and pork bellies in the 20th century. That is precisely what made Chicago tick, by colonizing nature and by colonizing the countryside. That has always been historically the dynamics of urbanization and the city. However, I would also argue that the city takes historically very specific forms. That is, that you cannot possibly compare the slave-based cities of ancient Rome or ancient Egypt with the capitalist cities of today. The dynamics through which mechanisms of inclusion and exclusion, the dynamics through which uneven social positions are maintained and reproduced, takes very, very different forms. Consider that in times of slavery, it was done through brutal repression by the state apparatus, in which everyone basically accepted also that that was the natural order of things. In the modern capitalist city, domination, exploitation takes completely different forms. We are, in the Western city, free people. Yet, it is a freedom that is still structured by particular social relations organized around entitlements to urban things like housing, public space, urbanized natures like electricity, water, food, etc. And that takes very different forms. Of course, we can see all manner of mechanisms through which people or put in their place, quite literally. This can take cultural forms, political forms, sometimes military forms. But what I want to insist on is that you cannot keep people in their place forever. The impulse for democratizing the resistance always takes over. That's why every city in history is simultaneously characterized by relationships of domination and exclusion, as well as by these fantastic outbursts of attempts to realize democratic desires. We find that in ancient Athens. We find it in contemporary New York.
I want to thank the caller. I have some others. I need to take a very short break here. We'll talk some more with our guest, Eric Svingedal, in just a moment. This is Focus.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. In the second hour today, a program that we do every month on the show, we call it Computers and You, and it's an opportunity to ask questions and do troubleshooting. If you have a computer and it's not doing what you need it to do, maybe we can help you out if you call in. We'll have a couple of people who are very experienced, Debbie Fleiger and Jim Irick. They're here every other month. Debbie is with Sites on the U of I campus, and Jim works with the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. So computer questions, hour two. Tomorrow morning, we will talk in the first hour of the show with Larry Grossberg. He's now teaching at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, was on the faculty here for a long time. We'll be talking about politics and the increasing tendency to divide up the field into two camps, each mutually exclusive. He says that doing that really is not very productive, especially for the left, but for anybody, he says. And he says he's interested in talking about returning to the model of the counterculture of the 60s, a movement of movements, as a different model for a political struggle. So we'll talk about that with Larry Grossberg tomorrow morning on the show. We're here weekday mornings, as I say, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. You can go to the website and look at the schedule, and that way find out what we'll do in the days ahead. That's will.illinois.edu. You can also listen to past programs. You can follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media, and you can also find us on Facebook. This morning in this hour of Focus, we are talking with Eric Svingedal from the School of Environment and Development at the University of Manchester in the UK. And he is here visiting the campus to give a talk. This is a talk in the MillerCom series. The title, Every Revolution Has Its Square, Repoliticizing the Unequal City. His visit here is sponsored by the Departments of Geography and also Urban and Regional Planning. His talk is this afternoon at 4 at the Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum. It's on South Gregory on the U of I campus. These MillerCom events are always free and open to the public, and if you would like to hear him, you should stop by. Questions here, welcome to 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. We have some other callers, and we'll talk next with someone in Effingham, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. The thing that strikes me is the use of the word democracy in a capitalist society and the function of the elites, as your guest has referred to, and how that is possible except as a propaganda tool. Thank you.
Yes, this difficult word, a democracy. It is extremely complex. A few comments on this. I do agree with the person calling in that capitalism as an economic system that systematically produces inequalities on the one hand, and that it requires in its proper functioning sustained political intervention. The market cannot exist without state intervention. That's precisely what the crisis over the past 2 or 3 years has shown, whether it's Bush or Obama, the bailing out of the elites of the U.S., the bailing out of Wall Street, is something they shared. So there is an ambivalent relationship between the nature of the economic system that we embrace on the one hand, and the nature of the political system that we cherish so much. In fact, China is here, or Russia. China and Russia today are very, very good examples, in the sense that they have both embraced a market economy of some sort over the past 10 years or so. They have been every capitalist red dream. They have been growing at rates of 8, 9, 10, 12% a year, something that Europe and the United States, not even in the best of times, has achieved. It's a magical wonderland of growth, development, economic expansion in radically authoritarian systems. No one would define China or Russia as properly functioning democracies with any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. It basically shows that it is a complicated relationship between the functioning of the economy and the nature of the democratic system on the other hand. So we are today in a very strange situation, particularly in the global north, Europe and the United States, where we have all embraced the final victory of democracy as an institutional form of organizing political life after 1989. Remember, we won. Democracy won. Mm-hmm. And we have embraced that. And quite successfully so, in many ways. I do not want to in any way deny the extraordinary achievements of democracy over the past 20 years or so. Yet, today, we see the proliferation of people having this strange demand. Real democracy now. The Spanish call it the indignados in the squares of Madrid and Barcelona calls it democracia real ya. Real democracy now. What is that? Spain, to take that example, has been this extraordinary example of successful democratization after having lived through the longest dictatorship that the West has ever known, Franco. Mm-hmm. So no one would today say that Spain is not a democratically constituted society yet. Hundreds of thousands of indignados say, we want real democracy now. So there seems to be a gap between the everyday politics of instituted democratic organization, which I have argued earlier, takes the form today of post-democracy. That is the elites agreeing among themselves on how to organize the geographies of the world. Mm-hmm. And through that, producing all these inequalities and undermining the very democratic principle. So what the Spanish indignados ask is based on the democratic principle, that is the presumption of equality of each and all qua-speaking beings. That is what the democratic invention, and we can argue when precisely historically democracy was invented, its invention was based on the presumption that we're all equal, in the face of the objective fact that sociologically speaking, we are unequal. Along class, gender, racial, and other lines, the world is a highly unequal place. We know that, and you don't have to be a great scholar to see that. But that is not what the democratic political is based on. It's based on the presumption of equality. And that is precisely what these insurgent movements stand for. Mm-hmm. It's very comparable, to take another U.S. example, it's very comparable to what happened in, was it 1955, 1956, when Rosa Parks got on the bus and on the wrong seat. She knew precisely what she was doing, of course. She knew that she was exposing herself to the violence of the state by infringing the laws of racial segregation. She was not the first one to do that. Others had done it before, knowing full well what they were doing. But in that singular act of sitting down on that wrong seat, she performatively staged the principle of democratic equality in the face of the blatant inequalities that were enshrined in what was also then a democratic constitution. And the democratic institutional frame in the United States was a democracy, too, in 1955, 1956. Yet any, in other words, any instituted order perverts, undermines the very principle of equality upon which, nevertheless, its constitution is based. And these democratic insurrections, in their performative staging of equality, show socially, geographically, and politically precisely the wrong that what undermines the principle of equality. So if we think of democracy, we have to split it into two. Mm-hmm. That is the everyday organization of democratic life in which all manner of actors and agents participate in the process of policy making, the sort of thing that we all read about in newspapers every day, and which is always aristocratic. It's always some who are participating in it, who have a proper voice and place within these configurations of policy making. Mm-hmm. And we understand that quite well. On the one hand, and the democratic yet political as the assertion, the staging of the assumption of equality of each and every one who are speaking beings, or in other words, that every voice counts precisely as that, as a voice, not just as a rumbling noise that is annoying somewhere in the background and that is and whose signal is faded out, if possible. That's why it's very interesting. When in September, October, when London, Liverpool and Manchester were burning, just a few months after the heroic struggles of the people in Egypt, Lebanon, etc. Was happening, James Cameron, the Prime Minister of Britain, who had fully applauded the insurrections of the Middle East as proper democratizing moments and processes, ultimately sending troops to Libya to help and support this democratizing desire. When similar sort of eruptions of deep discontent exploded in the streets of the big cities of the UK, what did he call these people? Scum. Rakai. Terrorists. In other words, people who are not entitled to have a voice. Mm. He repeated verbatim what Sarkozy, the president of France, in 2005, one of the first moments of outbursts of urban violence, you may perhaps remember, when thousands of cars were burning in the suburbs of Paris, Lyon, and the other big cities in France. Sarkozy, who was then Minister of the Interior, not yet president, he called the rioters rakai, scum. In ancient Greek, the word for rakai is ochlos, those who are not entitled to have a voice. Ochlos stands against the demos. The demos is the people. The people as political subject, that is those whose utterings are registered as voice. Now, a democratizing procedure is precisely staging and demanding the right to an equal voice by those who do not have a voice. So in that sense, the civil rights movement was a proper democratizing movement. And I would argue that in the choreographies of what we see unfolding today, we see similar desires being acted out and choreographed out in these insurgent spaces, in these urban squares that we've been talking about. Yeah.
We're coming down to maybe have about 5-6 minutes left. We have a couple of callers. We'll try to get them in, and the time that remains. And next in line is someone in Urbana on line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to go back to the formation of cities and the contention that they might have been formed to control slave populations may hold up with Rome, Athens, and perhaps the other Greek cities, and particularly Babylon. But it certainly doesn't hold up in Egypt, where slavery never became an important part of the economic system, at least until the Ptolemaic period. And I believe there's reason to suppose that the Persian Median empires did not practice slavery on anything approaching the scale of the Babylonian and Roman. But just what the earliest cities, the social structures were, I think no one really knows. They were probably Canaanite cities, and we really don't know very much about their history or their social structure.
Well, okay. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Again, I'm not an urban historian, and certainly not an historian of pre-modern urbanization. I agree that there are still many unknowns, of course, but I am particularly interested in the process of urbanization today, which is very, very different, I would insist, very, very different from the historical origins. Today we live in a world of planetary, what I would call planetary urbanization, which is radically different from the kind of imperial, yet geographically circumscribed forms of urbanization that the caller was talking about. Today, there is no isolated city any longer, no isolated city empire any longer. Today, our urbanization process is a globalized one. That is, that every single life and every nook and cranny of the earth is structured in and through the process of planetary urbanization, and one that keeps on unfolding at an extraordinary speed, at an extraordinary speed, and one that is ultimately not sustainable. That cannot go on, given the extraordinary resources, both human and natural, the resources that need to be continuously mobilized in order to sustain this process of planetary urbanization, is increasingly leading us to both social as well as ecological catastrophe.
Yeah. All right. I want to take the caller. Go on to line number one here, Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. I guess this is cross-disciplinary, too, anthropological, I guess, but I'm intrigued to think that the ramparts of the world, the city-states, were it wasn't just for protection, it was for keeping people in. That's never thought of that before, and that came from a caller. So, but the presumption that democracy and market economies are synonymous and evolved together is apparently belied in a number of realms. Anthropologically, there's a theorist of the Occupy movement named David Graeber with the book Debt, the first 5,000 years, who says it's pretty clear that this image we have of early barter economies is not right. And when you have such a basic misconception of how early society developed, it seems like, and you're building, you know, the impression of modern society on this, that you obviously are going to misconstrue many things. And whether people know that this is the case or not, I don't know, but it works on their behalf, basically. I don't know how clear that is, but it just seems to me that analyzing this in the way that this broad strokes, you sort of have to look at some of these basic, I think, misconceptions. I don't know how you'll react in the last moments here.
Yes, I do agree with that, and as I said, there is a very tenuous and complicated relationship between urbanization and democracy. On the one hand, the old saying goes, urban air makes sets free. That's why people go to Manhattan, go away from the repressive conditions they find in rural parts of the world, etc. It is, the city is a place of potential emancipation. So I like to summarize, the cities are simultaneously the places where the whip of the repression and disempowerment is mobilized with often all its power possible, but is simultaneously the site and offers the places where emancipation and realization of one's dream is really possible. And it's that tension that needs to be nurtured and continued rather than closed down.
Well, you know, we're coming down to the point, we have about a minute or so left, and maybe this is a not a question that would be in your area, and we don't have very much time with it, but I'm interested in the fact that so many of the places we've talked about where there has been this display of discontent are old cities, Cairo, Athens, places like that, yeah. And it's natural that it would happen in the places where it's possible for large numbers of people to gather.
Yeah.
I'm curious about whether you think that if some people around the world, some governments had it to do over again and could build a new city, they would build cities without places like that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That makes it so vitally important in our contemporary or the new cities to fight for public spaces. Yeah. Urbanity is a common life, a common experience. What we've seen happening over the past 2 decades or so is precisely the privatization, the encroachment of private control over what is ultimately a public space. It is the result of a collective production in which all manner of people have co-produced this gigantic, fantastic oeuvre that we call the city. And it's precisely its publicity, its public character that has to be fought for and maintained.
Yeah. I suppose the other side of that is, though, that having those spaces where people can congregate does... If you are interested in repressive control, it does actually give you some advantages because all people, they're all right there, and all you have to do is surround them, and you have them at your mercy.
Absolutely, but also, usually what the police says is, move on. There is nothing to see here. What they're most afraid of is people who get stuck in a place and say, we're not going to leave. That is when things get interesting.
Yeah. Well, I'm so pleased that you could have some time to spend with us. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Eric Svingedal, from the School of Environment and Development at the University of Manchester in the UK, he'll be giving a talk. This is part of the MillerCom series. The title, Every Revolution Has Its Square, Repoliticizing the Unequal City, this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the U of I campus. This is in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. All of these events always are open to the public and are free. Also, thanks to the folks in the Department of Geography and Department of Urban and Regional Planning for making it possible for us to talk with our guests. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. It was a real pleasure to be here.